Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with author Steve Lopez. His story of destitute musician Nathaniel Ayers is being made into a film starring Jamie Foxx and Robert Downey Jr. Jason Pfeiffer visits the South African theatre company, the Farber Foundry, on a visit to Philadelphia. The company has transposed a trilogy of ancient Greek tragedies to a more contemporary context. Susan Lewis takes us to Fashioning Kimono, Art Deco and Modernism in Japan, a new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And David Patrick Stearns looks ahead to Leon Fleischer's performance of Paul Hindemith's Piano Concerto for the Left Hand tomorrow evening with Christoph Eschenbach and the Curtis Symphony. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In 2005, on a busy street corner in downtown L.A., former Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Steve Lopez heard a beautiful melody being drawn from a battered violin by a shabbily-dressed homeless man. Nathaniel Ayers had once been a promising musician, studying bass at Juilliard. Now destitute and suffering with mental illness, he was living on the streets. What started off as a series of columns for the LA Times turned into a mission for Lopez, and he has, over the past 3 years, formed a close friendship with Ayers that has taken the musician off the streets and into a more stable existence. Steve Lopez tells this story in a new book called The Soloist, and in a soon-to-be-released big-budget movie. Lopez talks about his experiences at the Central Branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia this afternoon. He spoke with us yesterday morning.
Downtown Los Angeles is a very busy place. It's thousands of people walking to and from work, and he did not appear to be playing for money. He didn't have the violin case open. He didn't have a hat out. He was just playing to play music. And I said, well, why do you pick this particular spot? And he pointed across the street, and he said, there's the Beethoven statue. I play here for inspiration. And so then I knew I might have something, but it took several visits to figure out what this guy's story was. And with each visit, he warmed up to me a little more, and I was able to tug the story out of him. And the big break comes when he's scratching names on the sidewalk, and I ask him, who's Betty and Albert and Tom and... Rebecca, and he said, those were my classmates at Juilliard. And I said, Nathaniel, you went to the Juilliard School for the Performing Arts? He said, oh, yeah, that was a while back. He said it quite nonchalantly, like it's no big deal to go to Juilliard. And I'm thinking, okay, we've got an African-American man, homeless, playing a violin, missing two strings, went to Juilliard. I think I've got a column.
Nathaniel, at this point, wouldn't have appeared to have been a very, shall we say, reliable source. How did you go about verifying this story?
Well, you know, I would ask Nathaniel on the street there, who can I talk to get the backstory on this? And how did you train in Cleveland? How did you become a musician? And he said, well, you know, I grew up it was kind of a tough neighborhood. His mother had a beauty salon. His dad was out of the picture. Mom had music on in the beauty salon. And Nathaniel just took to the music. He'd go there after school. The ladies are all having their hair done. And Nathaniel's enjoying the music. And his mother says, maybe you should take piano lessons. So he does a couple years of that and then goes to junior high band. And that's, you know, we're talking 60s when public schools in America had extensive arts programs. It was considered part of a well-rounded education and everybody was handed an instrument. And the arts were big. It was before we got into the three R's and not much else. So he had a natural thing for it, and his junior high band teacher had him playing several instruments, but nobody could play the bass. And Nathaniel was a strong kid, and they needed a rhythm section, and Nathaniel was pushed in the corner with the bass and became so good on it in such a hurry that his teacher, Mr. Moon, said, I can't help you. You're going to have to go to see this guy in the Cleveland Symphony. His name is Harry Barnoff. He's been in the orchestra forever, and he teaches some of my better students. And that became his tutor. So I'm on the street in downtown L.A., and I said, Nathaniel, who influenced you? And he said, oh, you can call Mr. Harry Barnoff in Cleveland. And I said, well, how do I get hold of him? And with an index finger, thin air, writes out his phone number. And I scribble it in my notebook, and I said, are you still in contact with him? He said, nope, I haven't talked to him in decades. So I'm calling the number thinking it can't be any good. And somebody picks up on the other end and says, Barnoff residence.
Wow.
So Harry Barnoff told me that Harry was in tears when I told him that his former student was playing a two-string violin in downtown Los Angeles living out of a shopping cart. And he said, that was one of the most promising students I ever had, and my heart is broken hearing this. He was such a great kid, and it was so tragic to see his crash.
People, we love a great story about redemption, and this really is just such a story, is it not?
This is, I think it's a story about second chances and human connections and the power of art and music. It has saved him. In his third year at Juilliard, he starts getting very confused and having trouble focus. And when you go through the transcripts, if he's having to sit in a classroom and study the history of music literature, his grades are falling. If he's in performance with the orchestra, he's getting A's. And the teacher comments are, promising young talent, renew his scholarship, unlimited potential. Nobody knew that he was losing his mind. And Juilliard at the time, as far as I can gather, was not a welcoming place. And there was nobody there to pick up on little emotional problems or psychological problems. And there was one teacher there, a bass teacher by the name of Gary Carr, who went on to be the rare person with a solo career as a bassist, who saw that Nathaniel was having problems. And he told the administration, they said, no, he's just a troublemaker. And he said, no, he is losing his mind, which indeed he was. So he crashes, goes home to Cleveland. He's in and out of his mother's house. He's on the streets. He realizes he can't lug a bass around in a shopping cart. He saves up money working at Wendy's and shoveling snow, walks 15 miles, buys a violin, and has been trying to teach himself other instruments all these years later. So I meet him, and he's down and out, but... You know, this serendipitous encounter leads to what has been a really deep and meaningful three-year odyssey and one of the most meaningful relationships and friendships in my life.
Steve Lopez. He'll talk about his book, The Soloist, at the Central Branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia this afternoon at 2.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
While South Africa dismantled its apartheid system in the early 1990s, scarring memories of the system's brutality and racial segregation remain today. Several years ago, a South African theatre company, the Farber Foundry, set out to create a play that would explore its country's process of coming to terms with its tragic history. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, a trilogy of ancient Greek plays provided the framework for the Farber Foundry to examine the subject. Melora, the resulting work, is now in Philadelphia.
Melora was adapted from the bloody storyline of the Orestai by the ancient Greek playwright Aeschylus. The trilogy of tragedies, first performed in Athens nearly 2,500 years ago, involves Electra and Orestes, who have vowed to avenge the death of their father, murdered by his wife and their mother, Clytemnestra. Yael Farber, the founder and artistic director of the Farber Foundry, says the cycles of violence and family infighting in the Orestai story captured the themes that she wanted to deal with in her play.
I was looking for some way to articulate what had happened in South Africa, the country I grew up in, and the transition into democracy that was a relatively peaceful and bloodless transition after almost half a century of being under a very brutal fascist regime.
In the aftermath of apartheid, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was set up. Over a three-year period, hearings were held in community halls and churches across South Africa, in which the victims of the state's apartheid aggression and those who committed the violations sat at tables and sometimes heatedly discussed their experiences and crimes.
The survivors would have a chance to face their perpetrators and hear these testimonies and testify themselves. And it was an extraordinary event in which people could try to come to terms with the past and what had happened.
Farber's adaptation of the Orestai takes place in a Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearing. Only the characters are not from post-apartheid South Africa, but ancient Greece. Electra faces her mother, Clytemnestra. Through flashbacks and testimony, mother and daughter recount their bloody past.
I have hated you so long, and now you want to look into my heart. You... who did this to my father will pay.
Electra's testimony, performed by Jabalile Shabalala, illustrates the point that cycles of violence and revenge are not easily broken. But a central message in Melora, which means ash, as in embers, is that they can be broken. Hope can rise up from the ashes of tragedy. Dorothy Ann Gould, who plays Clytemnestra, says that in the South African context, one can see that a cycle of revenge was broken.
Due to the capacity for forgiveness, or as in our country we talk about, Ubuntu.
The way of reconciliation that Gould says so many South Africans have chosen is represented in Melora by the play's chorus. When first developing the play, director Yael Farber knew the Greek chorus of the story would be a crucial component, as the performers collectively serve as the conscience of the story, the ordinary people of the community.
I was looking for how to create the chorus, which is a device that was obviously once very potent in ancient Greek theatre, but very often I find fails in modern theatre. It's very conceptual and we can't really relate to it.
Farber decided to portray the Greek chorus with a small rural performance group. Though they have no previous theater background, with their traditional songs, instruments, and indigenous attire, the group of six women and one man remain on stage the entire show. They act as witnesses to the story, and at times they participate in it. Jabulile Shabalala says the chorus group, with its dancing, music, and mere presence on stage, powerfully complements the action of the story.
Every song goes with the situation, you know, with the scene. It's a pity that some of the songs are being sung, you know, in our native language. It's in Xhosa.
A pity, perhaps, but the songs are hauntingly beautiful, even without understanding the lyrics. And the tone set by the chorus, scene by scene, is clearly understood. One of the most remarkable aspects of the chorus's music is the split-tone singing that's woven throughout the play. Solwana Mbaipeli, also respectfully known as Teacher, is the leader and interpreter of the chorus group. The traditional style of vocalization has been passed down for hundreds of years in his culture.
We have two tones at the different intervals.
Would you mind demonstrating what we're talking about with, like, a split tone?
The split tone sound of the chorus has a very ancient quality, according to Dorothy Ann Gould.
Coupled with the Greek tragedies, which are 2,500 years old, it is absolutely perfect because it sounds like a sound that is 2,500 years old. So for us as actors, the heart and soul, the rhythms, take us back to a very primal place.
Going back to ancient Greek culture and beyond, cycles of violence and revenge, like singing traditions, have persevered through the centuries. Genocides, slavery, world wars. It was less than two decades ago that South Africa's apartheid system came to an end, but the Melora adaptation of an ancient story proposes the possibility of breaking such cycles through the power of forgiveness and reconciliation.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Melora runs through Sunday at the Harold Prince Theatre at the Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts in Philadelphia. Today, most people in Japan wear Western-style clothing, which took root there in the mid-20th century. But for hundreds of years before, the traditional national dress was a sleek, one-piece front-wrap robe called a kimono, secured at the waist with a sash called an obi. A new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art demonstrates how in its later days as daily attire, the Japanese kimono adapted its ancient form to modern sensibilities. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Fashioning Kimono, Art Deco and Modernism in Japan.
Beyond a doorway curtain, a visual field of color adorns the pale walls of the new windowless gallery. Fabrics in brilliant reds and turquoise, yellows, purples, oranges, pinks and greens. Some are detailed and delicate. Landscapes painted on or woven into the surface. Some have floral patterns or other natural motifs. Still others boast large, bold, geometric shapes or wavy lines that seem almost to move. These works could be decorative wall hangings. They are, instead, kimonos, which means literally thing to wear.
These kimonos do look like art the way we have them here because they're flat and they're spread open and you can really see them, but it's important to remember they really were worn.
Christina Haugland, the Philadelphia Museum of Art's associate curator for costumes and textiles, says these kimonos, like all clothing, Western dress included, make a statement about values and identity.
These kimono that have all these updated modern designs from that period are really a way to be very modern, yet still be Japanese.
This exhibition of approximately 80 kimonos focuses on the period from the early to mid-20th century, when Japan began incorporating Western ideas, culture, and dress. They're part of the private holdings of Jeffrey Montgomery, an American living in Switzerland, who, while traveling to Japan collecting folk art such as ceramics and lacquer, happened upon some kimonos.
I would see these in shops and in marketplaces, and I would walk by them, and then I would be thinking about, oh, that design was, it just reminded me of Art Nouveau, Art Deco, and who in the Western world would even think of putting colors and designs together in that manner? And it works.
While all clothing may make some kind of statement, the kimono's rectangular design from a single swath of fabric with minimal cutting or tailoring gives its creator a large, flat surface on which to paint or design. Only when the kimono is worn and tied with its sash, or obi, does it take on the shape of a human figure. Either way, Felice Fisher, Philadelphia Museum of Art curator for Japanese and Asian art, says it's definitely art.
And some kimono are even painted by famous artists. So they're a moving canvas, if you like.
While these kimonos are hung for display, vintage photographs in this exhibition illustrate how the kimonos were worn. The first section of the gallery provides historical context, with kimonos that illustrate the traditional styling and patterns. Some are adorned with images of bamboo or plum blossoms, and birds, particularly cranes. Styles and techniques reflect the wearer's status, says Haugland.
The longer sleeves are worn by young women. These black kimono are worn by married women for the most formal occasions. So there's a whole sort of rank of the kimono, and this small section reflects that.
One brilliant red under kimono has a woven design of cranes and leaves integrated with a pointillistic pattern of white dots illustrating shibori, an elaborate tie-dyeing technique once forbidden to commoners. Shibori involves bunching up and binding, in this case, hundreds of tiny pinches of fabric, so when the whole cloth is dipped into the dye, the pinched fabric won't take the color. Under kimonos and linings could be used to hide something beautiful or forbidden, or perhaps just more flashy than the wearer would want the entire world to see. For example, many men's kimonos are, on the outside, dark and conservative. Think business suit. But on the inside,
their linings and their under kimono could be very, very elaborate, either elaborately patterned under kimono, or then the jacket linings could be hand-painted with scenes that really reflect the traditional Japanese brushwork and that kind of thing.
In the first half of the 20th century, technology produced new synthetic dyes and machine-made fabric. Onto these traditionally shaped garments were put distinctively modern images, like those on a kimono for a little boy, which caught the attention of Karen Caruza, an instructor at the Art Institute of Philadelphia.
And the print are these stylized cars from the 1920s. So right there, that is fast-tracking him from the little boy with maybe a traditional dark-colored kimono with a very faint print on it, and he's being fast-tracked now into the age of modernism, the machine age.
Modern images, both representational and abstract, were used in women's kimonos with bold colors and large instead of small designs. Some were wavy in the style of Art Nouveau, some more Art Deco, with angular shapes, big polka dots, even, in one kimono, images of the Empire State Building. These were part of a larger cross-cultural exchange of ideas, says curator Felice Fisher, that began in the 1800s.
I guess the most obvious example are the Japanese woodcut prints and Impressionist painters, and the Europeans getting it. Then the Japanese coming to Europe, to Paris, to study painting in the 20s, and bringing back Art Nouveau and Art Deco to Japan.
The oldest kimono in this exhibition dates from around 1950. Today, women in Japan wear kimonos for special occasions, as Temple University student Takako Sato did for her coming-of-age party when she was 20. Sato regards the kimono as a highly personal connection with her own tradition.
Wherever I am, if I put it on, I will become a Japanese woman who don't have to envy any other race or ethnicity. I can be proud of being a Japanese woman.
Yet the kimono is also sparking interest as fashion. Art Institute of Philadelphia instructor Karen Caruza says her American students today are fascinated by this ritualistic garment.
What makes a geisha so beautiful and so erotic when she's all covered up? You know, it's the color that peeks out that's coming through, the shift of the kimono, how far it shifts back and how much of the nape of the neck and the back shows, because that's the erogenous zone in that culture. So that's really similar to low-rise jeans here. The further the dip is, you know, the more erotic.
Cool clothing, beautiful art. The kimono fits well in history, on museum walls, and wrapped around the human figure as the newest, as well as one of the oldest, ways to express identity, tradition, and evolving culture.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Fashioning kimono, art deco, and modernism in Japan is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through July 20th. The world would have fewer piano concertos from the 20th century's most significant composers were it not for Paul Wittgenstein, the Viennese pianist who lost his right arm in World War I and built a repertoire for himself by commissioning the best composers, among them Ravel, Prokofiev and Britten, to write music for his remaining left hand. But just because Wittgenstein built his own repertoire didn't mean that he liked all of it. One of the best concertos, Hindemith's Klaviermusik mit Orchester, wasn't played at all, but left in closets and warehouses until being discovered in 2002 in a Bucks County farmhouse. The piece will have its first local performance by the Curtis Symphony Orchestra on Sunday at the Kimmel Center, which will be recorded for release on the Ondine label. Behind the piece, says Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns, lies an odyssey with psychological questions that may never be answered.
Composer Paul Hindemith seemed to smell trouble ahead when, in 1923, he sent his piano concerto off to the man who commissioned it, Paul Wittgenstein, with a note saying, "You might find it a bit strange to listen to at first." The young Hindemith had known scandal, but his clavier music had no incendiary qualities. He even talked about writing it with love. Yet the pianist never played the piece. In a silence that lasted some 8 decades, performers and scholars tried to wrest the work first from Wittgenstein, who died in 1961, and later from his widow, who lived in rural Pennsylvania and died in 2001. These are the sounds that have been locked away. This world premiere performance with Leon Fleischer and the Berlin Philharmonic under Simon Rattle took place in 2004. Since then, Fleischer has played Hindemith's Klaviermusik mit Orchester all over the world and now in Philadelphia.
This is from a very good period. The big surprise is what you might call the slow movement. I find that a very special kind of inspiration and originality. He anticipates Ravel in using the English horn in this most expressive and most mournful way. And compositionally, there's some delights in there. It seems to me that he's thumbing his nose a little bit at the 12 tonists. He has 11 of the 12 tones, and I find that a kind of a wry wit that he was very capable of.
Hindemith's Klaviermusik mit Orchester would have been discovered rather sooner if Philadelphia conductor Jonathan Sternberg, now 89 and artistic director of the Bach Festival of Philadelphia, had a bit more luck.
I called everybody at Yale who knew Hindemith.
He had known about the piece since his post-World War II years in Vienna and began searching in earnest in the 1990s. He has an entire dossier of correspondence accumulated over the years with law firms said to represent the family, as well as the Hindemith Institute in Frankfurt, whose letter in German he is now reading. Sternberg was never told no. He just wasn't told much of anything.
No one, except the composer and Wittgenstein, knows the music of this concerto. No one has ever seen the score. That's all I can tell you, unfortunately. And that's all I can write to you, Mrs. Dr. Gisela Schubert.
Bringing great music into being is a noble endeavor. Hoarding it is hard to understand. But Paul Wittgenstein came from a fairly unimaginable world. He grew up in a wealthy Viennese family, but one that was so fraught three of his brothers committed suicide when their artistic aspirations were thwarted by their overbearing parents. Young Paul was not thwarted. He made a well-received debut as a concert pianist, but only a year later, after fighting in World War I, his arm had to be amputated. After the war, and eager to resume his career, he offered handsome fees to great composers, but with strict terms. He was to have the original score and exclusive performing rights, in some cases, for his entire lifetime. Emigrating to the United States in 1938, he was part Jewish, much of the Wittgenstein fortune had to be left behind. Living on Long Island with his wife and three children, he taught piano and played concerts at least through 1960. The Hindemith score still wasn't played, and despite interest from other pianists, wasn't released for performance. Who knows why? Leon Fleischer ventures a guess.
He paid for it. It was his. It was his property. And I think there was a certain bitterness in his approach to life. I guess he felt that once he had passed on, it would get out to the public. But, you know, while he was around, it was his.
Did Paul Wittgenstein value what he had? The Ravel Piano Concerto for the Left Hand, written for him, is a widely acknowledged masterpiece. Yet Wittgenstein was said to have had shouting matches with the composer over changes he wished to make. In one of Wittgenstein's few recordings, a 1937 live performance in Amsterdam, he adds his own flourishes. Prokofiev's Piano Concerto No. 4 was another Paul Wittgenstein commission that the pianist never played. He publicly stated that the music baffled him. No such pronouncements, it seems, were made about the Hindemith. Oddly, the score that was finally found wasn't the composer's but a copy. And why would Wittgenstein bother to have something copied were he not interested in performing it? Hindemith's stock was high in America when he taught at Yale. Wittgenstein had a reputation in New York. To judge from his reviews, he also had the public's sympathy. The question is if he had the fingers. His 1937 Ravel performance wasn't brilliant, and from what Sternberg knows, Wittgenstein wasn't just having a bad night.
That's why he didn't play Prokofiev. That's why he didn't play the Hindemith. He couldn't do it. He couldn't do it. There's no doubt about it. And from people I know who knew him, all said it was beyond his capacity.
The story of clavier music may not be truly over until the composer's own score turns up. The copy found in 2002 was so full of mistakes that the composer's surviving sketchbooks had to be consulted. Fleischer is still finding spots that might need correcting. He also believes that the original score no longer exists.
There were all kinds of rumors that Madame Wittgenstein used it to start the winter fires to stay warm and stuff like that. I have no idea. If it didn't turn up in her house, I think that was pretty much the last resort. You would think in our time that we could really put our finger on history, you know, really clamp it down and be able to examine it. It's amazing how we can't.
I might suggest that we get a Ouija board, except that beyond the grave, Wittgenstein might take forever to spell out Klaviermusik mit Orchester. And I don't think this is an accepted musicological practice anyway. The important thing is that we have this dandy little piano concerto at last. The composer wasn't always so amiable, soulful, and thrillingly uncomplicated, all in the same 16-minute piece. It makes me feel like I found a new friend.
Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns. Leon Fleischer plays Hindemith's Klaviermusik mit Orchestra with the Curtis Symphony Orchestra conducted by Christoph Eschenbach at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall tomorrow evening at 8. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Stephanie Grant and Elizabeth Flynn. Don't forget that you can listen to past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.